Welcome to Evening Under Lamplight, the show, as you know, that invites you to attend. I invite you to be there and to be aware. Be aware, first of all, that we are here on Cambridge Community Radio, Cambridge 105, and that I am Robert Louis Abrahamson, here to serve you. Write to me at lamplight at Cambridge 105 FM, Cambridge105.fm, and come listen to the archived podcasts of the shows at the website momentsunderlamplight.com. The show is going out on a special evening. It is the beginning of Pesach, Passover, and of Eastertide, two important festivals celebrating liberation and new life. Passover celebrates the angel of death's passing over the homes of the Israelite slaves in Egypt, and also the Israelites passing over the Red Sea in their escape from Egyptian slavery. Avodim Hayinu, we were slaves and now we are free. The Christians picked up the theme of freedom and celebrate the passing over of Jesus through death into new life, liberating the world from the slavery of death and sin. And someone suggested to me that the show tonight should take its theme from these celebrations, passing over or liberation. But we've covered similar subjects in previous shows. Instead, I thought we'd celebrate another aspect of these festivals, the new life of spring. Passover was the time of the spring barley harvest, and Easter is also a celebration of spring, coming after the season of Lent. The word Lent comes from the word lengthen, the period of the year when the days lengthen, daylight staying longer into the afternoon and evening. And the word Easter comes from Eastre, the Teutonic goddess of fertility, the rebirth in the spring of all the greenery rising from the dead earth. And what better at this point than to spend a few minutes meditating on these green spring energies, green thoughts in a green shade. The wild growth, the meshing together of kindness and anger, the new life springing up, confronting us, affronting us. Let's pause for the spring meditation from my CD Journey Through the Seasons. The meditation features poems by William Blake and Rumi, with passages also from Walt Whitman and T.S. Eliot. The music is written and performed by Neil Henry. Spring. From the winter we move to the spring, as the yang energy begins to grow, as signs of life appear once more. The color of this season is green. All those little shoots rising from the earth or budding on the trees. The rising of stem and branches as the plant steadily reveals its true shape. The organ associated with this season is the liver, cleansing and regulating the blood. It is also associated with the eyes. We must see clearly what is happening in these new growths around and within us. There are clues and hints in everything. The negative emotion is anger. Whatever new thing is being created, outside us, inside us, comes to us first as little shoots, little hints, and with them comes anger of many sorts. The selfish anger at having our winter stillness disturbed with new growth. The idealistic anger of awakening to the injustice of the world. The roaring anger of the newly released prisoner, raging in the first tastes of freedom. My devil had been long caged, and he came out roaring. The positive aspect of this anger is kindness. Our anger moves us outwards to recognize others and to be kind to our kin. This is the proper fruit of anger. Can I see another's woe and not be in sorrow too? Can I see another's grief and not seek for kind relief? Can I see a falling tear and not feel my sorrow's share? Can a father see his child weep, nor be with sorrow filled? Can a mother sit and hear an infant groan, an infant fear? No, no, never can it be. Never, never can it be. Anger can also lead to self-expansion and a sense of identity. We know the seed only once it begins to grow. Each moment of anger expresses something within us needing our attention. If we listen carefully to the cries of anger, we can meet these things within us and come to know who we are. Anger is our benefactor. It reveals our identity. Urge and urge and urge, always the procreant urge of the world. Out of the dimness, opposite equals advance. Always substance and increase, always a knit of identity, always distinction, always a breed of life. We don't always welcome these new shoots, which always challenge us with new growth. Let me be. If I change, I'll do it my way. At such times, spring can be cruel. It's so much cozier in the safe death of winter. April is the cruelest month, stirring dull roots with spring rain. Beyond this anger is the bustle of new growth, the acknowledgement of our own identity and the identities of others, as we bow in kind respect to each other. Again the violet bows to the lily. Again the rose is tearing off her gown. The green ones have come from the other world, tipsy like the breeze up to some new foolishness. Again, near the top of the mountain, the anemone's sweet features appear. The hyacinth speaks formally to the jasmine, "Peace be with you." And peace to you, lad. Come, walk with me in this meadow. Again, there are Sufis everywhere. The bud is shy, but the wind removes her veil suddenly. My friend. The friend is here like water in the stream, like a lotus on the water. Again, the season of spring has come, and a spring source rises under everything, a moon sliding from the shadows. Many things must be left unsaid because it's late. But whatever conversations we haven't had tonight, we'll have tomorrow. We'll have tomorrow. Spring is full of possibilities. It leads us deeper and deeper into kindness and compassion, and reveals richer and richer parts of our identity. That was the meditation on spring from my CD Journey Through the Seasons, Meditations on the Five Chinese Healing Energies. Find out more at www.journeythroughtheseasons.com. Yes, stop by soon. Our friendly webmaster is there now to guide you through the site. This springtime green energy can take us in various directions, and one of the most fruitful is towards the mythic image of the green man, the archetype of the power of nature to be always springing up anew, coming to us in sudden revelations, overturning all our human and technological pride with some more elemental force. To start us in this direction, I want to play a song we've heard once or twice before on Evening Under Lamplight, The Green Man by Malcolm Guite, a Cambridge poet, performer, and priest. The song reminds us that we can often find the face of the green man carved in old English churches, carved in the choir by your fathers in days of yore, as Malcolm puts it in the song. The Green Man is, he sings, the power in the pulse, the song underneath the sod. But look out, too. He's a trickster and may appear anywhere. I'm in the finest flower, I'm the power in the wickedest weed, and I'll plough your furrow with pleasure and plant my seed. And if we cut him down, he'll spring back green again.
My face in the foliage, you've seen that face before. Carved in the choir by your fathers in days of yore. I'm the power in the pulse, I'm the song underneath the soil. I'm the unseen king of the ditches, ragged and royal. I'm the Green Man, don't take my name in vain. I'm the Green Man, feel like break my chain. If you cut me down, I'll spring back green again. I'm the roots on the stalk and the tender shoots on the vine. I'm the goodness in the bread, I'm the wildness in the wine. There's power in the place where my smallest tendrils are curled, and my softest touch is the strongest thing in the world. I'm the Green Man, don't take my name in vain. I'm the Green Man, time to break my chain. If you cut me down, I'll spring back green again. I'm the grass at your feet, I'm the leaves that shade your head. Be your bower of love, I'll be your green grass bed. I'm in the finest flower, I'm the power in the wickedest weed. And I'll plow your furrow with pleasure and plant my seed. I'm the Green Man, I make love with the rain. I'm the Green Man, feel like breaking my chain. If you cut me down, I'll spring back green again. You can cover me in concrete, staple me down with steel. Spread your houses, your car parks over my fields. But I'll still be there, keeping everything alive. And I'll spring back green, but you might not survive. I'm the Green Man, don't take my name in vain. I'm the Green Man, time to break my chain. If you cut me down, I'll spring back green again. If you cut me down, I'll spring back green again. If you cut me down, I'll spring back green again.
Thank you, Malcolm Gait and the Green Man. But I want to move to a more specific Green Man this evening under lamplight, namely the ancient goat god Pan, the figure seen bounding through the hills or heard in the far distance playing his haunting pipes, awakening us to the wonder of the wild natural world. We see Pan in a book many of us will have read when young, though the chapter featuring Pan is often left out of abridged versions of Wind in the Willow. Wind in the Willows. In this chapter, Rat and Mole journey along the river on a quiet summer night, late at night, just before dawn, in fact, just at the gates of dawn. Rat hears an otherworldly melody, and soon Mole hears it too, and we enter the story as they go in search of that music. Attend to the way Kenneth Graham describes their mystical encounter with the god Pan, who awakens in them a spring energy and a painful joy, or a joyful pain of longing. Slowly, but with no doubt or hesitation whatever, and in something of a solemn expectancy, the two animals passed through the broken, tumultuous water and moored their boat at the flowery margin of the island. In silence they landed and pushed through the blossom and scented herbage and undergrowth that led up to the level ground, till they stood on a little lawn of a marvellous green, set round with nature's own orchard trees, crabapple, wild cherry, and sloe. "This is the place of my song dream," The place the music played to me, whispered Rat as if in a trance. Here, in this holy place, here, if anywhere, surely we shall find him. And then suddenly the mole felt a great awe fall upon him, an awe that turned his muscles to water, bowed his head, and rooted his feet to the ground. It was no panic terror. Indeed, he felt wonderfully at peace and happy, but it was an awe that smote and held him, and without seeing, he knew it could only mean that some august presence was very, very near. With difficulty, he turned to look for his friend and saw him at his side, cowed, stricken, and trembling violently. And still there was utter silence in the populous bird-haunted branches around them, and still the light grew and grew. Perhaps he would never have dared to raise his eyes, but that, though the piping was now hushed, the call and the summons seemed still dominant and imperious. He might not refuse, were death himself waiting to strike him instantly, once he had looked with mortal eye on things rightly kept hidden. Trembling, he obeyed, and raised his humble head, and then, in that utter clearness of the imminent dawn, while nature, flushed with fullness of incredible colour, seemed to hold her breath for the event, he looked in the very eyes of the friend and helper, saw the backward sweep of the curved horns gleaming in the growing daylight, saw the stern hooked nose between the kindly eyes that were looking down on them humorously, while the bearded mouth broke into a half smile at the corners, saw the rippling muscles on the arm that lay across the broad chest, the long, supple hand still holding the panpipes only just fallen away from the parted lips, and saw the splendid curves of the shaggy limbs disposed in majestic ease on the sward. All this he saw for one moment, breathless and intense, vivid on the morning sky. And still as he looked, he lived, and still as he lived, he wondered. Rat, he found breath to whisper, shaking. Are you afraid? Afraid, murmured the rat, his eyes shining with unutterable love. Afraid? Of him? Oh, never, never. And yet, oh, mole, I am afraid. Then the two animals, crouching to the earth, bowed their heads and did worship. That was Nicholas Daniel playing Pan from Benjamin Britten's Six Metamorphoses After Ovid. He was playing the oboe rather than the pan pipes, but we'll hear some real pan pipes later. Before that, I was reading from Kenneth Graham's Wind in the Willows, the chapter called The Piper at the Gates of Dawn. Oh, that name rings a bell for you? The Piper at the Gates of Dawn? Something to do with Pink Floyd or perhaps Van Morrison? Both took this title for their own uses, but this evening under lamplight we're not stopping at those places, just saluting them as we move past. Critics, and probably the author himself, acknowledge Graham's debt here to Robert Louis Stevenson, especially to his essay called Pan's Pipes. And I would like to spend some time, if I may, taking us through this short but important essay. Stevenson wrote Pan's Pipes in 1878 for a weekly newspaper run by his friend W. E. Henley, with the astounding title of London, the Conservative Weekly Journal of Politics, Finance, Society, and the Arts. The circulation was tiny. Even Stevenson's parents cancelled their subscription. But this gave Stevenson the chance to play around with outrageous ideas and styles. Pan's Pipes is one of the best pieces he wrote for that newspaper. And this discussion goes out especially for Bill in Bristol, who greeted me as I sat down to dinner at a recent conference with the news that he uses this essay in his undergraduate lectures. Stevenson starts the essay by remarking that we can explain our world through science, reducing it to formulae and chemical ingredients, or poetry, with its high-sounding measures for the handiwork of God. But whichever approach we take, it's not easy, given the confusions and contradictions of the world. There is beauty and repulsive violence and ugliness. Things are not congruous and wear strange disguises. The consummate flower is fostered out of dung, and after nourishing itself a while with heaven's delicate distillations, decays again into indistinguishable soil. And with Caesar's ashes, Hamlet tells us, the urchins make dirt pies and filthily besmear their countenance. Even the kindly shine of summer turns out to be the result of the most portentous nightmare of the universe, the great conflagrant sun, a world of hell's squibs, tumultuary, roaring aloud, inimical to life. And yet it is by the blaze of such a conflagration, to which the fire of Rome was but a spark, that we do all our fiddling and hold domestic tea parties at the arbor door. How then do we speak about such a complicated world? How do we convey this mixture of benevolence and malevolence that is part of the experience of each of us? Scientific formulae, Stevenson implies, are too neat and orderly to do justice to the mess of our world. We need poetry and myth to convey a real sense of our experience. Let's hear how Stevenson puts it. The Greeks figured Pan, the god of nature, now terribly stamping his foot so that armies were dispersed, now by the woodside on a summer noon, trolling on his pipe until he charmed the hearts of upland ploughmen. And the Greeks, in so figuring, uttered the last word of human experience. To certain smoke-dried spirits, matter and motion and elastic ethers, and the hypothesis of this or that other spectacled professor, tell a speaking story. But for youth and all ductile and congenial minds, Pan is not dead, but of all the classic hierarchy alone survives in triumph. Goat-footed, with a gleeful and an angry look, the type of the shaggy world. And in every wood, if you go with a spirit properly prepared, you shall hear the note of his pipe. That was a little weird. It was part of a piece called Scratched Pan by Azzurello, who plays the panpipes himself and then adds electronic music. It's suitably eerie for our experience of Pan, goat-footed, with a gleeful and an angry look, the type of the shaggy world. And so Stevenson is suggesting that if we turn our backs on those spectacled professors with their theories and prepare ourselves to attend to the spirit of the world around us, we will see Pan. But wait, what do you mean we will see Pan? Pan is not real. Well, yes, that's true, but neither is a scientific theory real. It's an abstraction, and Pan is a mythic figure, a symbol, also an abstraction. Both are just representations of what we experience in our lives, and the question is, which abstraction and which representation is more appropriate to describe our world, or which fits more with our own hearts? And of course, there's really no quarrel between science and poetry or myth. These are two different ways of speaking about the world around us, both valid, both useful, as long as we understand their specific ends. I have little patience with those who would set science and myth into conflict. There's some sort of ego game going on then, or power play. It's more ignorant than any primitive superstition, and more destructive, but very pervasive on both sides. The virtue of the myth of Pan, to return to Stevenson's essay, is that he is not a one or the other figure, but a multifaceted one, just like our world itself. For, as Stevenson says, "For it is a shaggy world, and yet studded with gardens, where the salt and tumbling sea receives clear rivers running from among reeds and lilies, fruitful and austere. A rustic world, sunshiny, lewd, and cruel. What is it the birds sing among the trees in pairing time? What means the sound of the rain falling far and wide upon the leafy forest? To what tune does the fisherman whistle as he hauls in his net at morning, and the bright fish are heaped inside the boat? These are all airs upon Pan's pipe. He it was who gave them breath in the exultation of his heart, and gleefully modulated their outflow with his lips and fingers. The coarse mirth of herdsmen shaking the dells with laughter and striking out high echoes from the rock, the tune of moving feet in the lamplit city or on the smooth ballroom floor, the hooves of many horses beating the wild pastures in alarm, the song of hurrying rivers, the colour of clear skies, and smiles, and live touch of hands, and the voice of things, and their significant look, and the renovating influence they breathe forth, these are his joyful measures, to which the whole earth treads in choral harmony. To this music the young lambs bound as to a tabor, and the London shop girl skips rudely in the dance. For it puts a spirit of gladness in all hearts, and to look on the happy side of nature is common, in their hours, to all created things. Alas, if that were all! But oftentimes the air is changed, and in the screech of the night wind, chasing navies, subverting the tall ships and the rooted cedar of the hills, in the random deadly lightning or the fury of headlong floods, we recognize the dread foundation of life and the anger in Pan's heart.
The sky's so brilliant blue. suddenly to gray. The cherished things are perishing and buried in their tomb. There is no hope, no reasoning, this rainy day in June. Everybody felt the rain. Everybody felt the rain. Everybody felt the rain. Everybody felt the rain. The demon stretched its wrinkled hand and snatched a butterfly. The elves and gnomes were hunched in fear, too terrified to cry. The reckoning was beckoning their living to their doom. There was no hope, no reasoning, this rainy day.
Rainy Day in June, from the album Face to Face, our Kinks song on Evening Under Lamplight at Cambridge 105, community radio in Cambridge. And I'm Robert Louis Abrahamson, playing around with Pan's Pipes with you. I don't know what lies behind that Kinks song. My guess is that one sunny, warm June afternoon, the clouds suddenly came up and all the skies, so brilliant blue, turned suddenly to grey. And Ray Davis, with a spirit properly prepared, as Stevenson puts it, perceived a mythic vision of what was going on. He saw Pan on what had been just a sunny afternoon. Now, we just heard Stevenson describe the kindly side of Pan, but what about the angry side? Remember that anger is the other half of spring energy, kindness and anger. Pan contains them both. Here's more from Stevenson. Oftentimes the air is changed, and in the screech of the night wind, chasing navies, subverting the tall ships and the rooted cedar of the hills, in the random deadly lightning of the fury of headlong floods, we recognize the dread foundation of life and the anger in Pan's heart. Earth wages open war against her children, and under her softest touch hides treacherous claws. The cool waters invite us in to drown. The domestic hearth burns up in the hour of sleep and makes an end of all. Everything is good or bad, helpful or deadly, not in itself but by its circumstances. For a few bright days in England, the hurricane must break forth and the North Sea pay a toll of populous ships. And when the universal music has led lovers into the paths of dalliance, confident of nature's sympathy, suddenly the air shifts into a minor, and death makes a clutch from his ambuscade below the bed of marriage. For death is given in a kiss. The dearest kindnesses are fatal, and into this life where one thing preys upon another, the child too often makes its entrance from the mother's corpse. It is no wonder, with so traitorous a scheme of things, if the wise people who created for us the idea of Pan thought that of all fears, the fear of him was the most terrible, since it embraces all. And still we preserve the phrase, a panic terror. And we must be sure to accept both aspects. Those who back away from the pleasures of Pan because they are afraid of the anger of Pan have missed the whole point. They conform to social custom and resign from living. to reckon dangers too curiously, to hearken too intently for the threat that runs through all the winning music of the world, to hold back the hand from the rose because of the thorn, and from life because of death. This it is to be afraid of Pan. Highly respectable citizens who flee life's pleasures and responsibilities and keep with upright hat upon the midway of custom, avoiding the right hand and the left, the ecstasies and the agonies, how surprised they would be if they could hear their attitude mythologically expressed and knew themselves as tooth-chattering ones who flee from nature because they fear the hand of nature's god. Shrilly sound Pan's pipes, and behold the banker instantly concealed in the bank parlour. For to distrust one's impulses is to be recreant to Pan. That was Georges Schmidt on the Pan Pipes playing Pastoral Evocation. We've come this far with Stevenson's essay on Pan's pipes. Let's continue to the end, the final paragraph, where Stevenson makes his plea for the appeal of living, mythic images, which will stir our hearts much more readily and healthily than intellectual scientific statements. He was writing in the first generation after Darwin, and he was no opponent of Darwin's theories of evolution. But in many ways, in many of his essays, we see him searching for a more human way to express these new ideas about the universe that will reflect how troublesome the world is to us. That's why he promotes the image of Pan in this essay. There are moments, he says, there are moments when the mind refuses to be satisfied with evolution and demands a ruddier presentation of the sum of man's experience. There will always be hours when we refuse to be put off by the feint of explanation, nicknamed science, and demand instead some palpitating image of our estate that shall represent the troubled and uncertain elements in which we dwell, and satisfy reason by the means of art. Science writes of the world as if with the cold finger of a starfish. It is all true, but what is it when compared to the reality of which it discourses? Where hearts beat high in April, and death strikes, and hills totter in the earthquake, and there is a glamour over all the objects of sight, and a thrill in all noises of the ear, and romance herself has made her dwelling among men. So we come back to the old myth, and hear the goat-footed piper making the music which is itself the charm and terror of things. And when a glen invites our visiting footsteps, fancy that Pan leads us thither with a gracious tremolo, or when our hearts quail at the thunder of the cataract, tell ourselves that he has stamped his hoof in the nigh thicket. Well, that was George Schmidt again, playing... Well, you recognized that, didn't you? It was Vivaldi's Winter Largo, the very theme tune of Evening Under Lamplight. How pleased I was to find this. Yes, it's winter rather than springtime, but sometimes spring turns to winter, doesn't it? And when it does, we now know whom to attribute this change to. Pan, with his tricksy, fearful pipes. There are many more references to Pan and his pipes we could bring in here, but we haven't the time, I'm afraid. I do, however, want to mention Jitterbug Perfume, one of Tom Robbins' extravaganza novels, which features, among much else, the god Pan, wild, horned, and horny, and stinking of a ruttish goat smell. The once supreme nature god Pan, we discover, has been weakened by the more inhibited spirit of Christianity and, the novel spreads itself over centuries, by the time of Descartes, the age of reason has made Pan all but invisible. If people do not believe in him, he fades away, like all discarded gods. But the problem is, if we forget Pan, and forget the reverential awe he inspires in us for the land, then the land itself will be destroyed, as we see in our own time. Pan begins to play his pipes. At first his playing seemed slight. It was so simple, careless, and primitive. But because it served no purpose, because indeed it transcended the human yoke of purposes, it was, above all, liberating. It was music beyond the control of the player's will or the listener's will. The will, in fact, dissolved in it. There was a sort of hippity-hoppity-rabbit quality to Pan's erratic melody, and also a roaming goatish quality, stubborn, rough, and lean. If at one instance it sounded tender and idyllic, at another threatening and brutal, perhaps that was because Pan's song was the inner animal's songs, all of them, summed into one seemingly random epiphany. And our heroes, listening to this playing, at first find themselves spontaneously dancing and then find themselves in a lusty state of arousal, she going off with Pan and he being tended by some of Pan's nymphs. That's not the Pan who gets into wind in the willows, but it certainly goes along with the classical representations of Pan and his priapic member. I've not really given you a taste of Tom Robbins' outrageous metaphors, playful, shocking, and always potentially offensive. And I think a community radio station is probably not the place for some of these images, so I'll just hold up a copy of Jitterbug Perfume and suggest that you might like to read it someday when you're feeling adventurous or with a spirit properly prepared for perceiving Pan and the rest of that company. Perhaps you might wish to be a pagan suckled on a creed outworn to enable you to see, hear, and feel the magic of Pan. But now, two songs to end with. Not connected with Pan, but with the theme of mythic approaches to life in preference to scientific precision and measurement and authentic realism. Myth fights against the realistic impulse, aiming instead to present unrealistic images, to attract our attention and arouse our emotional response to the patterns working in our lives. It wasn't easy to choose a Dylan song for this show. We don't find Pan very much in Dylan's songs, but we always find a lot of myths, especially the myth of the Westerns, the outlaw, and the loner. And then all the songs that turn real people into mythic heroes, Woody Guthrie, Joey Gallo, Hurricane Carter, Blind Willie McTell, Catfish Hunter, John Wesley Harden, Lenny Bruce, and so on. But let's look this evening under lamplight at the song She Belongs to Me. What interests me here is the way he turns his lover into a goddess. He does not describe their relationship with any realistic details, such as her looking so fine with her hair flowing in the breeze. Instead, he mythologizes her into some exotic deity. Not only does she wear an Egyptian ring with the magical property of sparkling before she speaks, but she has power over nature. She can take the dark out of the nighttime, he says, and paint the daytime black. But she's also a lurid goddess, whom we worship, but in doing so seem to degrade ourselves as we wind up peeking through her keyhole down upon our knees. Notice, too, that like all the deities in Greek tragedy, the law can't touch her at all. Not even, perhaps, the law of gravity or of mortality. No, his lover is not really like this, but this is the mythic representation of how it feels to be her lover. But enough of me. Here's the song.
She's got everything she needs. She's an artist. She don't look back. She's got everything she needs. She's an artist. She don't look back. She can take the dark out of the nighttime and paint the daytime black. You will start out standing proud to steal her anything she sees. You will start out standing proud to steal her anything she sees. But you will wind up peeking through her keyhole down upon your knees. She never stumbles, she's got no place to fall. She never stumbles, she's got no place to fall. She's nobody's child, the law can't touch her at all. Egyptian ring, it sparkles before she speaks. She wears an Egyptian ring, it sparkles before she speaks. She's a hypnotist collector, you are a walking antique. Bow down to her on Sunday, salute her when her birthday comes. Bow down to her on Sunday, salute her when her birthday comes. For Halloween, buy her a trumpet, and for Christmas, get her a drum.
And after Dylan, let's end with some Leonard Cohen, with a song of his that fits perfectly into what we've been talking about here. Cohen wrote Alexandra Leaving as an adaptation of a poem by Cavafy called The God Forsakes Antony, about an incident told by Plutarch when under siege in the city of Alexandria, Mark Antony perceived his patron god Bacchus leaving. But Cohen turns this into a love song, a mythic song about the ending of love. Things in this mythic level happen suddenly, just happen. The whim of the god. Suddenly the night has grown colder, some deity preparing to depart. Alexandra hoisted on his shoulder, they slip between the sentries of your heart. We cannot explain this, nor must we try to. We must just be open to what happens and suffer, if that's what we are called to do. Even though she sleeps upon your satin and wakes you with her kiss, don't be fooled. Do not think the moment is imagined. Do not stoop to strategies like this. She is still there next to you in bed. That sense of the god of love taking her away, oh, that's just a myth, you say to yourself. But that's just some strategy to avoid the moment rather than to face it. Say goodbye to Alexandra leaving, and say goodbye to Alexandra lost. and being scientific, looking for some reason why her love has gone, is to choose a coward's explanation that hides behind the cause and the effect. It's cowardly because we are engaging our intellect as a diversion from our heart. We use it to hide from the painful feelings. The myth, however, helps us focus on and move through the pain. You who were bewildered by a meaning whose code was broken, crucifix uncrossed, say goodbye to Alexandra leaving, then say goodbye to Alexandra lost. And I'll say goodbye, too, now. Robert Louis Abrahamson, thanking you for attending Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105, Community Radio in Cambridge, and looking forward to seeing you next time. May your spirit be prepared for encountering Pan and all the other mythic figures that surround us. And good night now.
Suddenly the night has grown colder. The God of love preparing to depart. Alexandra hoisted on his shoulder. They slip between the sentries of the heart, upheld by the simplicities of pleasure. They gain the light, they formlessly entwine. Radiant beyond your widest measure, they fall among the voices and the wine. It's not a trick, your senses all deceiving. A fitful dream, the morning will exhaust. Say goodbye to Alexandra leaving, then say goodbye to Alexandra lost. Even though she sleeps upon your satin, even though she wakes you with a kiss, do not say the moment was imagined. Do not stoop to strategies like this. As someone long prepared for this to happen, firmly to the window, drink it in. Exquisite music, Alexandra laughing. Your first commitment's tangible again. And you who had the honor of her evening, and by that honor had your own restored. Say goodbye to Alexandra leaving. Alexandra leaving with her Lord. Even though she sleeps upon your satin, even though she wakes you with a kiss, do not say the moment was imagined. Do not stoop to strategies like this. as someone long prepared for the occasion. In full command of every plan you write, do not choose a coward's explanation that hides behind the cause and the effect. And you who were bewildered by a meaning whose code was broken, crucifix uncrossed, say goodbye to Alexandra leaving. Say goodbye to Alexandra lost. Say goodbye to Alexandra leaving. Then say goodbye to Alexandra lost.